Okay, nice to see you all. The title for this talk is the five most important minutes of Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is not a holiday that we tend to think of in terms of five-minute chunks. One of the things that is overwhelming about Yom Kippur, aside from just the magnitude of the day, is the magnitude of the davening. We're in shul for much longer than many of us are used to during the year. And the davening experience can seem overwhelming. I remember as a kid, especially if you don't have a really good sense, thank you.
Amen.
Especially if you don't have a really good sense of the structure of exactly how all the prayers hang together, it can just seem to go on and on and on, and you feel like you're lost in this ocean of words. And the problem is that that experience can have kind of a reverse effect, which is on the one hand, you feel that you're supposed to be having this really intense and spiritually transformative day, and on the other hand, your mind is wandering, and you're wondering when it's all going to be over with because you can't grasp the whole. So I want to sort of do a little thought experiment with you, which is that imagine that you said to yourself, I could only concentrate for 5 minutes. Imagine like if you said, I have ADD or I'm a very busy guy and I can only spare like 5 minutes for God on Yom Kippur, right? So which 5 minutes would you pick? You know, I think that's like an interesting experiment. So like if you consult Art Scroll, for example, or at least the ads for the Art Scroll Machzor, you'll notice that the ads for the Art Scroll Machzor tend to open to Unasana Tokef, right? You know, that's what they display. So would it be Unasana Tokef? Is that what you should do? So it's a very scary prayer, right? You know, sometimes we enthrone it as the center of the kind of Kedusha experience. But probably wouldn't be Unasana Tokef. What would it be? So what I want to do with you today is try to attack that question from the perspective of the Rambam. Ask yourself, what would the Rambam say? You know, if the Rambam were alive, and you could ask the Rambam, what are the five most important minutes in Yom Kippur for me to pay attention to? What are the 30 seconds on Yom Kippur that I should pay attention to most? What would it be, you know? And I think the Rambam might give us an answer to it, and although we can no longer consult the Rambam in the flesh, we can consult his works, and I think a close reading, or even a not-so-close reading, of elements of the first two chapters of the Rambam's Hilchos Tshuva will point us in a helpful direction. So much of what I'm going to do today, if our time allows, is go through elements of the Rambam's Hilchos Tshuva with you today in an attempt to answer this question. And if we have a little bit more time at the end, I'll try to show you a ramification or an example of what the Rambam is talking about within some text of Chumash itself, but I make no promises as to whether we'll get to that. The notion of Hilchos Tshuva itself, that there should be such a thing as Hilchos Tshuva, if you really think about it, is itself problematic. It almost seems like an oxymoron. Hilchos Tshuva. What is halacha? Halacha is law. Law is all about fitting round pegs into square boxes. It's all about saying, look, we don't really care about your individual circumstances. These are the rules. This is what you have to adhere to, whether you like it or not. Law seeks to focus on external behavior and demand certain norms in external behavior, and typically doesn't really engage our inner spiritual world that typically we think of as our own subjective way of relating to God. And if there's anything that is inner and spiritual and is a person's own personal spiritual journey that they plot in a way that's different from anybody else, you would imagine that is tshuva. Tshuva is, you know, real avodah shebelev. And the question is, how could it even be that there is such a thing as Hilchos Tshuva? How can you take law and apply it to this internal spiritual subjective process that we all call tshuva. Isn't that a contradiction in terms? But nevertheless, the Rambam suggests that there is something called Hilchos Tshuva, and evidently he feels that that there is a path, there are guidelines that can be laid out in tshuva, and I think what we'll find is that if we look carefully at the guidelines are there because they help you chart this inner path. There are certain common pitfalls that without guidelines, without these laws, you can fall prey to. And, you know, you think of tshuva as a wonderful thing no matter what it is, but it could be that there's such thing as good tshuva and bad tshuva. Tshuva done wrong, right, can possibly be a destructive process. And the Rambam's trying to guide you into what a constructive process looks like. So let's try to pay attention to it. But again, just to illustrate to you some of the problems at face value with the idea of Hilchos Tshuva, let me give you the following example. There's a law which you can find, I don't know if it's in the Rambam, I don't think so, you can find in the Aruch HaShulchan, for example, that when you say Vidui on Yom Kippur, that you are supposed to be standing. You're not supposed to be sitting. So now the question, of course, comes, because we can get into hair splitting, which we will sometimes do in halacha. You say, what if you're not standing and not sitting? What if you're leaning? Right? Could you lean? So then the question is, well, what exactly do we mean by leaning? Right? There's different kinds of leaning. So what's the definition of leaning? So now, as if I'm leaning on the lectern like this, would that be considered leaning? Or what if I lean on the lectern like this? Would that be considered leaning? What's leaning? So it turns out that leaning is, if you would pull away the lectern and I would fall, that's leaning, right? And then it's questionable whether or not the vidui that you say is valid because you weren't really standing. So again, you know, when it comes to what bracha you make on a strawberry, we kind of think like that sort of hair splitting is okay. But now you're going to come to me and say, but you're going to invalidate my vidui because of that? So in other words, like if I gave you this crazy situation, imagine here's this guy or woman, right? And it's Yom Kippur. And they go through this, and for the first time in years, they've had this cathartic Yom Kippur, right? And they've stood in Shemona Esrei for like a half an hour, there's tears streaming down their face, and they feel like they've really gotten a chance to look at their life and to make some resolutions, and they've gone through vidui, and as they're about to take their three steps backward, it dawns on them, oh my gosh, I've been leaning. You know what I mean? And it's like, what? So it's like a do-over, like in camp, you know, it's like when the badminton thing hits the net and it's a, like a let and you do the point over again. Like, how do I do that over again? You know what I mean? This is the problem. How do you take a tshuva-like process and submit it to halacha in this kind of way? But there is such a thing called Hilchos Tshuva. So let's try to learn it and see how it might guide the process. Let me begin by asking you the most fundamental question for the Rambam when he begins to discuss any topic. The Rambam in the Yad HaChazaka is really organized around Taryag Zvos. That's why you'll find as a koteret, as a headline, whenever the Rambam begins a new list of halachas, he's going to tell you which of the 613 mitzvahs are encompassed in the halachas he's about to tell you about. So the Rambam does that in Hilchos Tshuva as well. So really the very first question you have to ask when you have something called Hilchos Tshuva is tshuva a mitzvah? In other words, is it one of the Taryag mitzvahs? Is there a mitzvah to do tshuva? So I want to actually throw this question out to you. Before we even look at the Rambam, let me ask you, do you think that tshuva is a mitzvah in the Torah? Or, even better, do you think that tshuva should be a mitzvah in the Torah, right? In other words, if you were making up your own religion, and you had all these laws, and imagine they're identical to the Taryag laws, you came up with this great holiday called Sukkot, and you have this wonderful holiday called Pesach, and you've got these korbanos and things, you've got all these various different laws, and then, of course, there's tshuva, right? Very important part of your religion. Should it be one of Taryag or not? Okay, so we're just going to take a poll right now. I'm actually going to ask you that question, and I need you to raise your hand. You're going to have to take sides here of whether you think tshuva should be a mitzvah or not. And the rule is you all have to vote. Okay, so if you're in the room, there's no such thing as abstaining. Okay, everyone has to guess. So you just have to tell me, do I feel more like tshuva should be a mitzvah, or do I feel more like tshuva should not be a mitzvah? That's your decision. Are you ready? Okay. All of those who feel that tshuva should not be a mitzvah, raise their hands. Okay, all of those who feel that tshuva should be a mitzvah, raise your hands. All right, very interesting. It's about 50-50, okay? About 50-50. All right, now, I suppose if I would call on somebody who was in the pro camp and ask them to explain why tshuva should be a mitzvah, I'm pretty sure I would understand the argument, right? Tshuva is very important. It's very fundamental. It's at least as fundamental as al kol korbanecha takriv melach, bringing salt with all of your korbanos, which is one of the mitzvahs, right? So it should be a mitzvah, right? That would be the argument why tshuva should be a mitzvah. But I'm curious, and I'd like to call on somebody or ask somebody to volunteer from the con camp, from the negative camp, to explain to me your reasoning and why you think maybe tshuva shouldn't be a mitzvah. Anyone want to take a stab at that?
Because if you're following all the Targum mitzvahs, there's no reason for tshuva, so it should be a mitzvah.
Okay, good. Let me just press you for a moment, and I think you're exactly right, and I'll repeat your point in a moment, but but I'm just going to get into a little dialogue with you and play devil's advocate with you. So let me push you a little bit. What? Tell me your name. I can't... Sheila, okay, so it's hard for me to even see from here, and I have my glasses on. All right, so Sheila says tshuva should not be a mitzvah because all the tariag mitzvahs are mitzvahs, and you're supposed to do them, so you're supposed to be doing them. So how could you have a mitzvah if you're not doing it to do tshuva? So Sheila, can you just explain that to me? Because tshuva is this very deep and very spiritual thing. It's like the core of my religion, and I feel so wonderful and so spiritual and so alive when I do tshuva. How could you belittle my feelings and not include tshuva as a mitzvah, Sheila? Okay, you're right, but again, I'm going to come back with one more little pushback. Sheila, are you demanding that I should be one of the tzaddikim gemurim in the world who never sin? You're saying the Torah is made for people who never sin, like Yishai, and the five people who never sinned, and if you're not one of those, then you don't belong? I thought the Torah is made for all of us. How could there not be a mitzvah for the rest of us? Anybody else? You guys call complaining. I'm actually just playing with Sheila over here. There is a way to defend Sheila's position. What? How do we have a korban chatas, right? How could there be hilchas tshuva if there's no mitzvah? Okay, the truth is, I'm being a little too mean to Sheila over here. She's actually right. And I think the Rambam thinks that she's right, too. If you... Let's actually... look at what the Rambam says and ask ourselves, who does the Rambam agree with here? Okay, let's listen to his words and ask ourselves, does the Rambam consider tshuva mitzvah or not? Here's the Rambam's language. Kol mitzvah shebetorah bein aseh bein lo taseh. All mitzvahs in the Torah, whether they're positive or negative, im avar adam al achat mehen, if you transgress any of them, bein bezadon bein bishkaga, whether on purpose or by accident, kisha yase tshuva v'yashav mecheto, when you do tshuva and you return from your sin, chayev lehisvados lifnei akel baruchu, you have to say vidui, you have to confess your sins, and he quotes a pasuk, and then he says, vidui ze mitzvah saseh, this act of vidui is in fact a positive command, and he quotes a pasuk to express that and to show you that vidui is a mitzvah saseh, and that explains how you do. Ketzad mitzvadim, ana Hashem chatati aviti pashati lefanecha, asiti kach v'kach. All right, that's the Rambam's language. What do you think? Does the Rambam consider tshuva mitzvah or not? What does his language seem to imply? The truth is, the Rambam seems kind of ambiguous, if you think about it. Right? Listen to it one more time. All mitzvahs in the Torah, whether positive or negative, if you transgress any one of them, when you do tshuva, it is a mitzvah in the Torah to be misvada, to confess. So does the Rambam think that there's a mitzvah called tshuva?
No. He says when. She asks
the tshuva. Right. Notice that the Rambam said when. The Rambam didn't actually define a mitzvah here called doing tshuva. The Rambam says when you do tshuva, then there's a mitzvah. Right, a mitzvah that's triggered by doing tshuva, and the mitzvah is to include vidui in your tshuva process, right? To actually say vidui. Now that's very strange, because the Rambam seems to be taking a stand which is neither here nor there, right? He's not saying tshuva is a mitzvah, he's not saying tshuva is not a mitzvah, he's saying when you do tshuva, there's a mitzvah to include vidui. So the question is, how do we wrap our heads around that? Why would that make sense? So, yeah.
What would you be? You're doing vidui, which is a mitzvah saseh.
Yeah.
So what would you confess it?
No, you're confessing a sin. You've done something wrong. We all agree that we do wrong.
Is a mitzvah saseh.
Yeah. So okay. Well, hold on for a second.
Never be confessing. Now, it's you're playing semantics.
Well, let's just relax for a moment. How do we understand the Rambam? Let me offer the following. Well, I think what Sheila was trying to say before I kind of took her off track over there, what she was trying to say, I think, is the following. Sheila's argument really is that the 613 commandments are things that you're supposed to do. So God commands all of those things. So let's take a given command, right? Let's say one of the commands is you're not supposed to eat milk and meat together, and let's say I violate that. I'm into cheeseburgers, right? So I'm a cheeseburger eating person, and I'm violating the command with wanton disregard. I just eat cheeseburgers. That's my thing. Could there be a mitzvah for me to do tshuva? What Sheila's argument is, it would be superfluous to have a mitzvah for me to do tshuva. There's already a law on the books, which is, don't eat cheeseburgers. What is tshuva? Tshuva is stop eating the cheeseburgers. Change your ways, right? So there's already a law that I'm not supposed to be eating the cheeseburgers. You don't have to have another law that says stop eating the cheeseburgers. The first law that says don't eat milk and meat together is the same thing as the law that says stop eating the cheeseburgers. It's the argument that the NRA always has. Just enforce the laws on the books, right? Gun control is already there. Just enforce the laws on the, so just enforce the laws on the books. Even more than that, if what is a command? A command is when the Almighty comes to you and says, hey, listen up, here's what I want you to do. Now, if I'm already doing an Avera, given Avera, what am I saying? I'm not listening to the Almighty when it comes to this. So if the Almighty comes and says, oh, now do tshuva on that, I'm going to listen to you, I'm already not listening to you, that's why I'm eating the cheeseburgers. I'm going to listen to you when you say stop eating the cheeseburgers, I'm already not listening to you. You can't command me to do it. So what the Rambam is really saying, I think, is this. Tshuva is not a mitzvah, it's a choice. You have a choice, a personal choice to make, whether you want to do tshuva or not. We all sin. God can't tell you not to sin. He already told you not to sin. God can't tell you to turn around. You are the only one who can decide that. So kisha yasa tshuva, when a person decides that they want to turn around, then the Rambam says there's a right way to return and there's a wrong way to return. The right way includes vidui. Make sure you include vidui. That's what the Rambam is really saying. And that itself is kind of curious. Because what the Rambam is doing now is he is saying that one of the elements, and only one of the elements of tshuva is very special and must be included in the process. And we can probe a little bit further and ask why. What is so special about this element of tshuva? For example, you've all learned in school, or you've all learned at various adult education classes, you've all learned in the Rambam before, you know probably that the Rambam himself defines tshuva as encompassing a number of different elements, right? There's not just one different element. So the Rambam is going to isolate one of these and suggest that there is a mitzvah to include this element. But what about all the other elements in tshuva? For some reason, those aren't a mitzvah. Let's just remind ourselves what the various elements of tshuva are that the Rambam himself says, right? The Rambam himself, in Perek Beis, I'll just kind of read it to you, says, let's see if I can get it here on this phone. Oh, this phone is not obeying. Maybe it will obey now. Okay. So the Rambam says, Mahia tshuva. What is tshuva? So he says, well, there's a bunch of different elements. Element number one, Hu sheya'azav achotei cheto. What we call azivas achet. Right? Azivas achet is stopping to do the thing that's wrong, and as the Rambam says, yasir b'machshavto, you don't obsess it out anymore, you get it out of your mind, and you don't do it anymore. That is element number one. Element number two, yigmor belibo shelo yaseyu od, you have to decide that you're not going to do it again in the future. And then, v'chein yitnachem al sha'avar, you should regret having done it in the past. Shenemar ak yachrei shuvi nichamti. And then, tzorech lehitvadot besvatav, you need to confess out loud what it is that you've done, using the formula that the Rambam said before. So those are the four elements of tshuva. One of them is a mitzvah. And why is that? Okay, so let's leave the Rambam aside. We're going to come back and try to explain what he considers so special about vidui. And ultimately, the answer that I'm going to give you today is that according to the Rambam, the five most important minutes on Yom Kippur are those minutes, right? Those moments when you say vidui. That's really what it's all about. That's where your mind shouldn't stray. That is your focus. Everything else is just a setup for that somehow. So the question is, why should that be true? How does that make sense? How do we understand the logic of the Rambam here? So I'd like to take the four elements of tshuva as the Rambam describes it. Let's forget everything else we know about the Rambam, that vidui is a mitzvah, and just play our favorite Sesame Street game with this and ask which one of these things is not like the other, right? You know that game? It's the music goes on screen, and there's four little boxes. So you imagine there's four boxes, and each of the four boxes, there's one of the four elements of tshuva. There's aziva sachet, there's kabbalah la'asid, there is charata, right? And then there is vidui, those four elements that we just talked about. And now, just conceptually, Sesame Street has them on the screen, and you've got your, like, 5 seconds to figure out which one of these things just seems different than all of the others. Which would it be and why?
Vidui.
What do you say? Vidui. Okay. Why?
Because the other ones all reflect the fact that you're not going to do the chait again. That's tshuva. I mean, you decided to do tshuva, so you're not going to do the chait. But vidui requires a positive act to articulate that of what you did, which is different than saying, I'm not going to do it again.
Okay, 1 second. Saying I'm not going to do it again is just Kabbalah al-Asid.
Right, and I regret having done it.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, those are all related to the fact that I did something, and as you said before, God said not to eat cheeseburger, so I'm not going to eat the cheeseburger again. But that doesn't...
But 1 second, I'm just going to press back. I'm not going to eat the cheeseburger again is just Kabbalah al-Asid.
Yeah, and I'm sorry that I ate the cheeseburger. That's the other one. In other words...
Okay, so what? Let me put it to you this way: what element vidui have that the others don't have?
Oral statement.
Okay, it's an oral statement. So is vidui fundamentally different because it's an oral statement? That's one way you could look at it. Any other way you could look at how vidui is different than the others? Yes. Good, and also what's interesting about vidui is vidui needs to be in front of the one that you offended, realize, right? So as if it's in front of God, if you offended God, if it's in front of a person, if you offended the person. So which means that vidui is the only element here which is
interpersonal,
right? Or interbeing, right? Between you and another being like God. In other words, the other three elements, if you think about them, you can do all by yourself. The fourth element, vidui, you can't do all by yourself. It actually involves someone else. And that also might explain why it has to be oral, right? Because when I have to verbalize something, so I take it out of myself and I put it out there in the world and I give it to someone else, the person who's listening to me or the one who's listening to me. So there's something about vidui which involves another, or me in relationship with another, and the other elements, not necessarily. Azivas achet, I just have to stop doing it. Kabbalah asa, I just have to decide my feelings about the future, right? Charata, I just have to regret. All of these are decisions that I can make by myself. Vidui, no. Yes? The only... Right, so no, that's part of it. In other words, there's internal, and then there's external. There's what I bring to the table in terms of my relationship with others. Okay, so let's leave vidui aside for a moment. We'll come back to vidui. I want to just focus on the other three that aren't a mitzvah. If the other three aren't a mitzvah, why are they there? Let's just talk about what the other three elements of tshuva are, these things that aren't a mitzvah, and what role they play. Those things are aziva sachet, kabbalah ala asid, and charata. Now, here's my next question for you. Imagine that you are taking the SAT exam. Maybe you've had kids recently who've taken this. Maybe you've had grandkids who've taken this. Maybe you've taken it recently yourself somehow or other. But on the SAT exam, there used to be this question back when I took the SATs. They would give you this thing to read, and then they would say, what's the best title for this paragraph? Do you remember those questions? What's the best title for this paragraph? So imagine that you had the Rambam on the screen, and you were reading about the three elements of tshuva that were not a mitzvah, and you had to come up with the best title for this paragraph, but the title for your paragraph could not include the word tshuva, right? What words would you use to come up with the best title? How would you describe the best title for Aziva Sachet, Kabbalah Latid, and Charata? Okay. Good. I actually kind of like that.
What is that?
Say it a little louder.
Character reformation.
Character reformation.
Introspection.
Well, yes, but not all introspection necessarily leads you to reform your character. This is introspection which is designed to reform your character or to... reform your character
change.
Maybe is a little bit heavy.
Change.
Let's just settle on change, right?
Rehabilitation.
I'm going to rehabilitate myself. I'm going to change. So in other words, it's really about how you make change. How do I change? But it's how do I change myself? It's introspection. It's how do I...
Is it just one thing?
Yes. How do I change myself with respect to one thing? Just one thing. I just want to change with respect to one thing. How do I change? But, and the change, we can get a little bit more specific. It's change and it's reforming character through what thing in particular? What am I doing when I, A, leave a sin behind, B, accept I'm not going to do it again, C, express regret for it? What am I doing with respect to that wrongdoing? Am I owning it? Am I uprooting it? I'm aware of it? No, I'm owning it maybe in vidui, right? But not in these. What am I doing with it? I am leaving it. I am distancing myself from it. These are three ways of distancing yourself from wrongdoing. You're actually not owning it. Owning it is the opposite of distancing it. You're getting far away from it. Aziva sachet, I'm leaving it behind, right? What's interesting about these three things, to really get a handle on that, is what's different about these three things? How there are three things here. How are they each different from each other? Think about the element of time.
Past,
present, and future. Think about Aziva Sachet. With what time frame do I do Aziva Sachet? Stopping to do the thing wrong. Past, present, or future?
Present.
I stop it now. Right? Deciding not to do it again, past, present, or future?
Future.
Regret having done it, past, present, or future?
Yes.
Isn't that interesting? Past, present, and future. These three things relate to three different time frames, past, present, and future, which leads to the very interesting possibility that maybe these three things are all the same thing. They're identical. Maybe there's only one thing that differentiates each one from the other. Time. In other words, you can express it algebraically. You can say, do you know what tshuva is? Tshuva is really these things, but tshuva is actually one thing. Tshuva is X. But You can have x to the past, x to the present, and x to the future. When I have x to the past, I call it charata. When I have x to the present, I call it azivas ched. When I have x to the future, I call it kabbalah alatid. But what is tshuva? Tshuva is actually just x expressed in all time frames. That's really what the Rambam is saying. Now, what exactly is x? What is this thing that when I do it in the future, we call it regret? When I do it in the present, we call it leaving the sin behind. When I do it in the future, we call it committing not to do it. What is this thing?
It's a behavior.
It's a certain kind of behavior. What is it? It's azivas achet. It's really the present thing, right? It's actually leaving the sin behind. How do I leave a sin behind? How do I change? How do I leave a wrongdoing behind so it's no longer part of me? The Rambam says, it's not enough. You would think the only thing you have to do is azivas achet, just stop doing it and I've left it behind. No, the Rambam says, as a human being, you cannot leave a wrongdoing behind just by stopping to do it. There's actually other steps too. You need right now in the present to relate to three different time frames. You need to relate to now, you need to relate to the future, and you need to relate to the past. You need to decide you're not going to do it again, you need to express regret, you have to stop doing it. Why? Let me just illustrate this for you in a very practical way and bring down what would otherwise be a kind of abstract concept into very practical terms. Let's take an actual wrongdoing and I'll show you how this is true. Let's take our cheeseburger example from before, right? So let's imagine that here I am, David Foreman, mild-mannered guy, seem like one of you in all respects, except that I have this secret sin, right, which I keep from everyone, and it's my obsession with cheeseburgers, right? So I am really into cheeseburgers, and there's no better time to eat cheeseburgers than on Yom Kippur. So here I am, year after year, I'm in McDonald's during the break on Yom Kippur. It's a terrible thing. No one knows. Really awful. I feel very guilty about it. And this year, I decide it's time to turn over a new leaf. I really want to do tshuva. I'm going to leave this behind. I just want to get away from the cheeseburgers this time, right? All right, so comes Yom Kippur, and there I am. And I'm actually in shul during the break. First time in 10 years I've been in shul during the break. My friend Bob sees me, says, "Hey, Rabbi Foreman, what are you doing in shul during the break? I never see you here during the break." So I confide in Bob. I say, "Bob, this terrible secret I want to tell you. Really, like, I'm always at McDonald's. I feel terrible about it, but this year I'm changing. I'm here during the break. I'm not doing any more cheeseburgers. I'm not having cheeseburgers now." So that's very impressive, right? But what if Bob then would say to me, "Well, Rabbi, what about last year? How do you feel about the cheeseburgers last year?" And what if my answer was, "Those were the best cheeseburgers I've ever had. Let me tell you, it was like amazing. They had a new sauce that year." And like, and just thinking about that cheeseburger experience is what powering me through Kol Nidre. You know, just the memories of that cheeseburger, right? So Bob would say, like, "It's kind of impressive that I'm not eating cheeseburgers," but you couldn't really say I've left the sin behind. You know what I mean? I'm connected to it by virtue of my memories. I'm hanging on to it through the way I'm relating to the past. In order to really break my connection to cheeseburgers, I'd have to be able to say, "Look, if I had to do it over again, I really wish that I had done last year without the cheeseburgers." If I could say that, then I break my past connection to it. And similarly, Bob could ask me about the future. What if Bob asks me about the future and says, "So Rabbi, what about next year?" And what if I say, "Ah, just anticipating those cheeseburgers from next year," or what if I say, like, "Well, we'll take it one year at a time, not really sure, and in my heart of hearts, I'm thinking about those cheeseburgers and the possibility of getting back to them, and that's how I give myself the strength to get through this year." So I'm holding on to the cheeseburgers by virtue of my anticipation of them. You see, being a human being is a tricky thing. If somebody asks you, "Do you live in the present?" it's only partly true. Obviously, in time, we live in the present. I can't live in any other time frame but the present. But really, if you think about what makes you a human being as a human being, part of it is your ability to simultaneously live in the past, present, and future. Your anticipation of the future and your memory of the past enriches your present experience in a way that it's just effortless. It's just the way life always is for you. And if you would imagine life without it, you would feel very impoverished. For example, what would it be to go through life without any memories of your past? Right? You have no memory of your past. You're just locked in this. It would be like a prison. You're locked in this eternal present. You can never show anybody a picture of your kids. Somebody says, who are you? What do you normally say to identify yourself? You tell a story. You talk about your past. Your past is a crucial building block of your identity. The reason why we look at Alzheimer's as the most feared disease, perhaps of all, is because it cuts us off from our past, and therefore seems to shred our sense of living humanity. We live because of our relationship to the past. Similarly, we anticipate the future, and anticipating the future is really an important part of what it means to be human. When you're here today, you're thinking, you're planning, you have goals, you have desires, you're trying to achieve certain things, and if I would shred that and take that out of your life and force you to live into this present without any anticipation or planning or idea of where I'm going in the future, you would feel lost. You wouldn't be human. So since a human being lives that way, because a human being's experience of the present is always an experience of present anticipation of the future and remembrance of the past, and that's how I get my identity, then if I really want to change who I am, if I want to change my identity, I somehow have to take this part that I don't want anymore as part of myself, and I have to sort of sort it out of my present, my anticipation of the future, and my identity as far as my memories of the past. And I have to say, look, if I had to do it again, I'd do it without that. If I do, so this is what I have to do. This is the logic, I think, of the Rambam saying you need these three things. But the amazing thing is that if you would do all of this, you would consider yourself a big tzaddik, all right? Right? If I was the guy who had this cheeseburger thing, and I no longer, right, was eating cheeseburgers now, and I renounced my memory of the cheeseburgers, and I'm eating them in the future, you would say, I'm a real tzaddik. That's a really amazing thing. But you know what the Rambam would say? The Rambam would say, I haven't even gotten started yet. Because remember, these three things aren't the mitzvah. We're talking about the stuff that's not the mitzvah. A fascinating thing emerges from the Rambam, and it gets back to what Sheila was saying before, which is that, and what you were saying before, which is that what these three things are about is about change. These things are about character refinement. These things are about leaving behind a wrongdoing, which is what character refinement is all about. There is no mitzvah to do that. It's just a choice that you have to make. It's self-help, right? It is, if I want to be better, obviously I'm going to have to do that. No one can tell me, no one can force me to do that. Ultimately, I have to make that choice myself. The mitzvah of tshuva is the part of tshuva that's not self-help. It's the part of tshuva that involves someone else. That's the only part that there's a mitzvah, which means that there's a fascinating implication here about what the really important part of tshuva is. Vidui is very important. Why? There's something rehabilitative about vidui, not in terms of my own character, which only I can choose to make better, but in terms of my relationships with others. Every wrongdoing degrades a relationship. It either degrades a relationship with you and God, it degrades a relationship with you and other people, or it degrades both relationships. Somehow, vidui is intended as a kind of antidote to that, and that's the mitzvah. It's actually relational. It's between you and the other. It's about fixing a relationship. How would it do that? So the Rambam says something really amazing a little bit later on in Perek Beis. The Rambam gives an analogy, and it goes like this. He says, before you do vidui, before you confess your sins, you have to do the other three elements of tshuva, azivas achet, leaving the sin behind in those three ways we talked about. And if you don't, then the vidui doesn't work. Do you know what it's like to do vidui without doing azivas achet, without to apologize, to confess your sins, without having left behind a sin? He says that's actually like, and he gives the following analogy, pay attention here. It's like going into a mikveh and holding on, tovel v'sheretz biyado, and holding on to the sheret, to the insect, the dead insect that makes you impure. And it doesn't work. Going to the mikveh doesn't work. I believe that the Rambam there gave you a very precise analogy that you can mine for an understanding of how vidui works. Take apart the analogy for a second. Just understand its parts. In any analogy, there's going to be two parts here, right? What does each part signify? What is the sheretz in the Rambam's analogy? And what is the mikveh in the Rambam's analogy? Right? Listen carefully. Being misvada, confessing your sins without having done azivas hacheit, is like going into a mikveh and holding on to the dead insect that makes you impure. Now, in the Rambam's analogy, what is the dead insect analogous to? It's analogous to the sin, the wrongdoing itself. Wrongdoing defiles me. When I hold on to it, it defiles me. The point of azivas hacheit, as we just described, those three elements of past, present, and future, is to distance myself from the wrongdoing. There's the sheret that I'm holding. Distance myself from it. Cast it away. But here's the problem. In laws of Tumantara, simply casting away a sheret that I have touched does not make me pure. It just puts me in a position that I can go in a mikveh and become pure. So too, the Rambam says, tshuva does not make you pure. Tshuva, as defined by azivas hacheit, nearly leaving behind a sin, is an important prerequisite, but it doesn't really purify you. What purifies you in the world of Tumah? If we take this idea out of the ideas of Tumah and Tara, and we take it into the realm of character refinement, into the realm of wrongdoing and righteousness, what purifies you is actually the interpersonal act of vidui. Vidui is like a mikveh. It's like going into a mikveh. There's something magical about a mikveh, and when you emerge, somehow you're pure. That's why these are the five most important moments. This is the mikveh of Yom Kippur. This is where you get pure. This is where you get refreshed through vidui. Why? What is it about vidui that does that? How does that even make sense? So it turns out that vidui is a very interesting thing. If you look at the word in Hebrew, the word in Hebrew is leitvadot, comes from the shoresh yada, which is the same shoresh as saying todah rabah, thank you very much. In Hebrew, there really is not much difference between saying todah and leitvadot. It's really the same word. So the question is, why would the Hebrew language consider... The Hebrew language seems to consider thanks and admission of wrongdoing two sides of the same coin. They're actually the same thing. Whereas in English, we have two different words for this. In Hebrew, we only have one word. We call it hoda'ah. Why does hoda'ah have these two facets? Why is thanks and saying you're sorry actually the same thing? Hoda'ah also can mean to admire, to praise. So actually praise, thanks, and saying you're sorry. Somehow it's all the same thing. Let's talk about that. By the way, interestingly, Abraham Tversky, the psychiatrist, is reputed to say that there's really only three words that you need to know to have a good marriage. And his suggestion are the three words are actually the three facets of hoda'ah. It's thank you, I'm sorry, and I admire you. And if you could say those three things, you'll basically be okay. And the question is, why? Why are those the three? And the idea is that they're the mikveh, right? Whenever you get messed up, you can't say, my relationship is never going to get messed up. I'm never going to do something that degrades my relationship with someone I love. You are. The question is, how are you going to fix it? You have a mikveh to fix it. The mikveh is, I'm sorry, I admire you, and thank you. And those three things can restore relationships, kind of magically. Why? How does that even work? So let's get to the core of it. What would you say thank you and I'm sorry have in common? How are those the same thing? They're acknowledgments. But not all acknowledgments are thank you and I'm sorry. So if I acknowledge that this lectern is in fact a lectern, that would not be an act of hodah, right? So how is thank you and I'm sorry a particular kind of acknowledgment?
Recognize my dependence on others, my relation, my need for others.
My need for others. So thank you doesn't recognize your need for others. It recognizes...
Okay, good.
So if I would say, let's put it this way. How would you say thank you in English without saying thank you? What's the other way to say thank you in English?
I appreciate it.
What does the word appreciate mean? Value, right? To understand the value of, right? That is what thanks is. Thanks is I understand the value of it. If you think really about what I'm sorry is at its core, the way you say I'm sorry without saying I'm sorry is I understand the value of it when value is negative and when I did it. I understand what a terrible thing I did to you, right, is really the core of I'm sorry. It's understanding value. And the idea basically here is this. You can visualize any relationship that anybody has with anybody else as a kind of balance. The relationship starts when the two people are in balance with each other. And relationships like balance. And the worst thing a relationship hates is getting out of balance. Whenever a relationship gets out of balance, it wants to get back in balance again. Now, there are good ways to get a relationship out of balance, and there's bad ways to get a relationship out of balance. A good way to get a relationship out of balance is when someone does favors for me, what I do favors for you. So, for example, if I move into the community, and I'm here, and it's the night before school, and my kids don't know anybody, and you're my next door neighbor, and you come over and you introduce yourself, and you bring over a cake, and you bring over your kids, and your kids help my kids fill their knapsacks and tell them about the teachers and introduce them to other kids in school. So I feel immensely grateful, right? And normally, but now, see, what's happened is our relationship has got out of balance because you've given me this really wonderful thing. So what do I want to do now? I want to return the favor. I want to find some way to give back to you because I want to get our relationship back into balance. It's just a normal human thing. And that is a very, very key element. It's a very basic part of human relationships. It could be used in all sorts of ways. You can take advantage of this impulse too. If you're in the market for a new car and you walk into a car dealership and Chris sits you down at his office and says, so you're in the market for a new car, and he opens his private fridge and says, can I offer you a can of soda? You look hot. Don't take the soda. What's going to happen if you take the soda?
Obligation.
All of a sudden, your relationship's out of balance. Chris has done you a favor. What do you want to do now? You want to reciprocate to Chris. What's the only way you can reciprocate? Buy his car. So you just took a 35-cent can of soda, and you're going to spend $35,000 on Chris's car because it's the only way you can reciprocate his favor. So it's a very, very powerful thing, right? And marketers are told to do this kind of stuff. That's why Chris offers you the soda. So you have to be careful about this. But human relationships want to get back into balance. The problem is you can't always do it. I can't always reciprocate a favor. What do I do when I can't reciprocate a favor? Similarly, on the other side, let's say a relationship gets out of balance in a not nice way. What's that? Imagine that Bob does something terrible to you, right? Bob stabs you in the back, assassinates your reputation, writes something about you in the papers that isn't true, right? I mean, you feel it's the worst, right? So you're really angry about Bob. Now your relationship is out of balance. Bob has done this terrible thing to you. What do you want to do now?
Revenge.
Revenge, right? That's why revenge is sweet, because revenge rebalances relationship. But what if you're not the kind of guy that wants to take revenge, right? What if revenge is not always practical or desirable? What if a favor, a kindness, cannot always be repaid properly? So it's hard to live in an out-of-balance relationship. That's what hodah is for. Hodah is the magic, the mikvah, that can rebalance a relationship without reciprocation, when reciprocation can't be had or oughtn't be had. How does it work? Hodah, as you've said before, is acknowledgement. So here, what I'm about to tell you is strange and makes no sense, but it's true anyway, because it's just the way human nature works. And the way Hadal works is like this. When our relationship is out of balance, and you've given me this thing, and I think that the only way I can possibly balance our relationship is by reciprocating to get our things back in order, there's another way. The other way is, if I look at this favor that you've given me, and instead of putting it under the rug or avoiding it, I look you in the eye, and I recognize the value of the favor that you've given me, and I understand, say, I understand that you've given me this, and I am very grateful. If I convey that understanding to you, and you say you're welcome, our relationship can actually go on, and somehow there's a new balance that's been achieved in our relationship. Doesn't make any sense. I haven't done anything. I've just recognized the imbalance. That's all I did. Paradoxically, the recognition of imbalance brings balance back into the relationship. Makes no sense, but it's true. Same thing on the other way. That's what I'm sorry is. What is I'm sorry? Why is it so hard to say I'm sorry? It's so hard to say. I asked a bunch of kids once, how do you say I'm sorry without saying I'm sorry? So you know what one kid says? Raises his hand, he's very excited because he knows what his answer is. He says, you say I didn't mean to do it. And what if you meant to do it? Do you understand the problem here? So like, it's so hard to say I'm sorry, so we come up with fake apologies instead. Like, I didn't mean to do it, and really you did. Which is really just a way of avoiding recognizing the truth. Which is, I did this terrible thing to you. So what is an apology? It's a recognition that here is what I did. And the amazing thing about it is that if you accept that, here is what I did, I'm crushed, I feel terrible about what it is I did, I understand the magnitude of how it impacted you. If I convey to you that recognition and that regret, and you can accept it, our relationship can go on and can find a new kind of balance, which again makes no sense. The problem with vidui is that as the Rambam himself says, there's very little partial credit. It is magical, but you have to actually do it right. So on the 5 minutes of Yom Kippur that you spend doing vidui, the Rambam says, pay attention to what you're actually doing. It's not hard, but he says that it's actually three elements to vidui, and they all have to be there. He says, what is Iker vidui? Iker vidui, which is the 30 most important seconds of Yom Kippur, are really just three words. And the three words are, Aval anachnu chatanu lefanecha, right? We or I have wronged you. If you think about those three words, it's actually a very simple sentence. It has a subject, it has a verb, and it has an object. And the subject and the verb and the object all have to be there. And when they're there, the relationship can be rejuvenated. But when they're not there, if you compromise any one of these three words, you're in trouble, and it's hard to, it's really hard. So imagine yourself, imagine somebody wronged you deeply, and they come to you seeking to apologize. And they compromise one of those three words, either the subject, the verb, or the object. I wronged you. What would it look like to compromise the first word, I? To compromise the first word is, okay, the person understands that there was a wrong that was committed here. They understand that I was affected by it. But what they don't understand is that they're actually responsible for having done it, right? They believe that they really had no other choice. They think that they're not responsible. This is just what the situation demanded, so they did it. How easy is it for you to forgive them in that situation? If you disagree, it's not so easy. The I has to be there. I did this. I really did, right? The next thing has to be there is the verb, wronged. How easy is it for you to forgive somebody when they come to you seeking to apologize and they miss that verb? I made a mistake. Do you understand, Bobby? I'm so sorry. I made this terrible mistake. It was a mistake, the article in the paper about it. Do you know, that was a mistake? That wasn't a mistake. It's a sin. A wrongdoing is not a mistake. Everyone makes mistakes. Do you understand? A wrong is different than a mistake. If you can't get that verb, then you don't really understand. It's not a recognition. What about you? If you miss the you, you understand that you... The person, the subject understands they did it, they did understand that it was wrong, but they don't really get how it affected you. how you were impacted by this, and they come and apologize. How easy is it for them to forget, for you to forgive them? It's not easy. You have to really convey recognition of those three things, and it is so easy not to, which is what the political apology is all about. Right? Mistakes were made in my administration. Think about it. No subject, no verb, no object. There's nothing there. Do you know what I mean? Who made the mistakes? I don't know. We all know mistakes got made. Mistakes. They weren't wrongs. They were mistakes. And who did they affect? I don't know if they affected anyone. They were just made. They were made in my administration. They didn't affect anyone. Do you understand? So it sounds like an apology. You can have all sorts of ways of sounding like an apology. But in fact, it's not really an apology at all. I'm not going to have enough time to get with you to my example so much for this, which is unfortunate. For those of you who want to take a look, it was from the end of Vayechi with Yosef and his brothers, the final moment of reconciliation. Ask yourself, did they really reconcile? And I think if you look carefully, you'll find there was an almost apology there, and one of the three words got compromised. But you can do that on Yom Kippur, and you can do that in Rosh Hashanah, and you can discuss it with your friends. But what I do want to leave you with is a practical word for a moment. If these are the five most important minutes of Yom Kippur, so don't mess them up. This is really what you want to focus on. It's not about Nisan HaTokef. It's not about feeling as guilty as you possibly can feel and all of that. It's actually about trying to revitalize your relationships. Tshuva is a choice that only you can make, but ultimately that's about self-improvement. Self-help is a very nice thing, but it's not the mitzvah. The mitzvah is repair damaged relationships. Every time you commit a wrong between you and God or between you and others, you damage a relationship. The only mitzvah, the Rambam says, is try to repair the damaged relationships. And there is this mechanism, and the mechanism is called apology, right? Actually do it right. And the mechanism also, by the way, is thanks. If you haven't said thank you, right, find the people to say thank you, because that's also an aspect of vidui. And if you don't do that, your relationship is also not whole. So find ways to do that with people, to thank the people that you need to thank, to apologize to the people you need to apologize. It's not just about you sitting in shul and feeling guilty. It's also not about another thing. When you seek to reconcile with someone, there is what I consider a minhag ta'us, which has taken hold in our community. We used to do it in yeshiva all the time. And if I teach you anything today, or if you take away anything from this, I hope that you will avoid doing this Yom Kippur. That is, in yeshiva back in my day, on Erev Yom Kippur, we all used to go around to people, and we'd try to reconcile with them, so we would say these words. So would you be mochel me, please, you know, for anything I did? Don't do that. Okay, think about what you're doing when you say that. As the Rambam describes it, have you actually apologized to anyone when you say, would you be mochel me, right? No. Did you recognize any wrongdoing? No. Did you say, is there a subject, is there a verb, there's an object? No. Actually, if you think about it logically, there's a logical sort of thing, right? If you apologize properly to someone and you say, I feel terrible about what I've done, right? I think I really may have wronged you over this past year. Right? Could you accept my apology? That's one thing, right? So, but then the next stage after that, some point after that, is like, would you consider forgiving me? There's something that happens after that. But if you don't apologize, and you just come up to someone and say, will you forgive me for anything which I might have done? Blah, 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 what are you actually doing? You are actually shifting the moral onus on them. Do you realize how corrupt this is? You were the one, not only did you do this terrible thing. Now they're the jerk for not forgiving you when you didn't even come clean and say anything, right? So you ever have this where someone like really did something to you and they say, would you be mocking me for anything? Like, hello, right? Do you know what I mean? So it's actually real, right? And instead of finding as many people as you can to do the little mechila thing with you, right? Actually try to find a couple people you think maybe, or one person that maybe you didn't really say thank you to, that you should have said thank you to, that you didn't really say you're sorry to, that you could say, look, I really think I wronged you, I'm sorry. And if you can say that, those really are the five most important moments of Yom Kippur, between you and God, between you and others.
Could we stay for one more class? breathing demands.